I'm very pleased to welcome back to the Catalpa Escape podcast series for episode five, Margot O'Byrne. Welcome back, Margot.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, many of our listeners have been writing to me saying, "Where is chapter five? This is just too much suspense. We want to know what's happening next." As indeed do I. When we were together at the end of the fourth episode, we had Captain Anthony on his ship heading off into the Atlantic to catch whales on the face of it, but really heading somewhere else, like Fremantle. And on the other side of the US in San Francisco, we had the handpicked Breslin with his mate Desmond heading off to Sydney. And there's a sort of proposed pincer movement. We've got the Catalpa coming in from the Indian Ocean. We've got Breslin and his mate coming across the Nullarbor Plain, presumably, or maybe catching a boat around the Great Australian Bight to get to Fremantle. But that's where we sort of were. The Catalpa's been fitted out in New Bedford, off on the voyage, remembering a few of the people. Richardson had hand-selected the crew for Anthony, who had picked his own first mate, Sam Smith. And as we say, Breslin's been picked by John Devoy to be the guy with Desmond. And there we are. Now, I suppose we start, do we, this episode by recalling that out on the Atlantic, on the Catalpa, with his hand-picked crew who think they're hunting whales, is Captain Anthony, first mate, as well as this Irish carpenter, Dennis Duggan. What's going on out in the Atlantic?
That's right. Well, that's what we're going to focus on today, Michael. It's the journey across the Atlantic. And of course, we had Captain Anthony's out there, as you say. Richardson has actually selected the crew for him. So you can imagine that with any, it's a fairly small boat, and the captain has to get used to this crew and sort of suss them out, decide, oh, is that one good, or is, what, keep an eye on that one. So he was pleased, basically, with the crew that Richardson had chosen for him, and he was particularly impressed with the boat steerers, because when a whaler went out, they had various whale boats that were attached to the ship, and of course, when they found a whale, they would lower the whale boats and go out, and so they had this long steering oar at the back of it, and you needed very experienced people to do that. So he was pretty happy with that choice, but there was one guy that he felt like he had to keep an eye on, and that was George Bowles. And George was a 24-year-old from New Bedford, and Anthony thought he displayed a bit of a surly, defiant attitude. So, a captain would probably keep an eye on that one, wouldn't he?
Margot, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, and indeed over time in recent years. You forget that back here in the mid-1870s, that if you wanted to get somewhere around the globe, you got on a ship and went there. And there were ships going everywhere. I mean, if people get out their atlases and say, look at the Canary Islands, you can see that it's close to Portugal and Spain, belongs to Spain in colonial terms. It's not far across to Nova Scotia, not far down to New Bedford. And then you've got whole of Africa and South Africa at the bottom, and you look across the globe, and everyone's going on ships everywhere. If you're out there, it must be like today being in the air and being an air traffic controller. There are planes everywhere. There must have been ships everywhere.
That's right. And as our story progresses today, Michael, we'll meet some of those ships and find out how they actually interacted with each other along this journey too.
The other problem, of course, is you need people on all of these ships. And you mentioned George Bowles. I mean, not everybody comes packaged, I suppose. You might have the labour hire firm and you bring them all together and they vouch for you that they'll all stay on the same side. They won't mutiny, and they're good at their job. But
And
that's
if, yeah, that's right. And of course, we know that Anthony was taking them ostensibly on a whaling cruise, but and of course, in those days, people actually made the money. The value to a crew on a whale boat was that they had a good catch. because if they had a good catch, then they shared in the profit of that. So that meant that they were after that as well. And so they were all the time look, I guess a crew would have been sussing out the captain and seeing, you know, is this the sort of person who's going to take us to the right whaling fields, and can we make enough money out of this?
And we know that over time, people got into whaling and they had a sense of where the whaling fields were best around the globe, really. And as new colonial exploits happened, for example, Australia, people discovered there were whales there as well. But sitting around on a boat, I mean, what do you do all day? I guess if you're skippering it, you've got a job. But what about these whalers? What do they do? Play crib?
Well, life on board the whaling boat was, and even for crew on board, you know, shipping boats, shipping, you know, vessels today, it's a mixture of boredom and tension. So when there aren't any, there's no catch, what you're doing is you're cleaning out the bilges, and in this case on the Catalpa, they were checking the rigging and the sails. They had to lay out the canvas every morning according to the fluctuations of the wind, and the captain would order how much canvas would be laid out, then they'd have to run the canvas up and keep the ship shape, as they say. And then when they reached the whaling fields, of course, then there'd be a huge cry that would set off this burst of action and energy when they'd all scramble to their whale boats, and then they would have been really important that people knew what they were doing, because you really had to pull together in that situation.
Well, I know from seeing sketches of people in the olden days whaling that a little bit of what these boats look like. But do you have any idea just how big they are? And you were mentioning that steering oar. I mean, how big are these things?
Okay, so the whale boat, and if people listening in Fremantle want to get a view of one, there's one in the Maritime Museum. So you can go down there, and upstairs there's actually a whale boat and it's quite amazing to stand there and look at it and think, gosh, this was out catching a whale, seriously. So the whale boat itself was about 30 foot long. And it was 6 feet wide from beam to beam. So that's what, a couple of meters. And then the steering oar itself was 23 foot long, and it required a great deal of skill and a good dose of courage to actually
20,
keep it.
23 foot long, and you have to operate. That would take, well, not only skill and courage, but you'd have to be a little strong.
I think every single person on the whaleboat would have had a lot of muscle power. There would be no need for a gym in those days, Michael. They'd all be out there working and really, and you wouldn't hire crew who weren't strong enough to be able to withstand this sort of pressure of work, really.
We also know that it was an international crew. We discussed that on the last occasion. So
Yeah.
people are from here and there, and no doubt we'll come back to the crew. But what about knowing where you're going? How did they sail in those days? Did they have GPSs?
No, they had the chronometer was the most important instrument on board. So the Catalpa, remember when they fitted it out? So Richardson had purchased a new chronometer for the Catalpa, but unfortunately, Sam Smith, the first mate, and Captain Anthony were alarmed when they took the vehicle's position with the chronometer. And they found that the calculation showed them that they're in the interior of the state of New York. So they reset it, recalculated, and you would have had to know a fair bit about maths, I think, too, in the days to, you know, there were no calculators that you pressed and got answers to. So it was all figuring it out. And so then on the 1st of May in 1875, they spotted a German bark. And quite often, what would happen when they spotted another ship at sea is that they'd put up a particular flag, which meant, hey, do you want to stop and have a what they called a gam? So a gam was when you had a one captain to the other captain, and sometimes it wasn't just the captain, it was not, some of the crew as well, went across, had a bit of a chat, found out what conditions were like, shared a bit of information. So they went across to this German ship, and then the captain of the German ship, Anthony, was absolutely shocked to learn that the chronometer readings had placed the Catalpa 40 miles off its actual position. So that was incredibly alarming to him, even with their recalculations.
So they thought they'd fixed the granola, but they actually hadn't, and they had to recalibrate it, no doubt, or work with it knowing its defect. I might just observe here, I've also discovered over time that time that seemed to be a long time when I was small, like say 75 years, is no time at all. And Margaret, the events we're talking about, the 1st of May 1875, spotting that German bark, that was just 9 days and 75 years before I was born. And right now it's 75 years and a couple of months since I was born. Just in two generations, this was all happening out in the Atlantic. It's no time at all, Margot. But they are.
Our lifetime has speeded things up a lot, Michael.
So they're out there hunting for whales in the Atlantic, the North Atlantic, or thereabouts. Where are they sort of heading for?
Well, they were heading for the Canary Islands, really. That's where, but they so their purpose, remember, was they were coming to Western Australia, but they needed to hunt in those North Atlantic hunting fields for the whale in order to make enough money to pay for the voyage. That was part of it. The Clan na Gael had purchased the Catalpa, but the actual keeping this whole expedition, this whole mission on tack required quite a bit of money. So they were heading across for Fayal in the Azores at that stage. And on the 30th of May, the lookout's cry said that brought them all to the deck, and they thought, oh, here's the whales. But in fact, it wasn't. It was actually a British whaler called Florence that was in distress. And they were flying the distress flag. And so Anthony ordered that the Catalpa go closer to that vessel, and he boarded the vessel. And he found out that the ship was out of water and provisions. They were pretty much exhausted, and that the men were starving. One of the masts had fallen down and ripped the kelson during a gale, and then this had killed one seaman and injured three others. So Anthony ordered his crew to stock that brig with food and water, enough to see her through, as you said. Nova Scotia was one of their destinations, and then his crew rigged up two sails for the crew of the Florence and sent them off on their way. Now, if Anthony, this shows that this is another thing that was going on out there in the ocean. You couldn't call the sea rescue or send a satellite message or anything, could you? It was only one ship to another that would actually help in any times of distress. And
So just going back and staying with Anthony, we know he was with his wife was back at home, new baby, couldn't send an email. Were they in contact at all?
okay, so the next ship that they came across, Anthony actually quickly penned off letters and sent them off to his wife, Emma, and their baby, and to inquire about their baby Sophie. Now, remember, Anthony was only married earlier, within a year of this voyage, so he's still quite a young man, sort of with a young family, and I'm sure that he must have thought about them quite a lot out there on the ocean. And at times, I'm sure he wondered what on earth he'd chosen this mission for when he could have been at home having a very safe life. So
So
then.
it sounds like a nice place to be. And in terms of catching whales, were they successful?
Yes, so then on the 13th of June, they heard the cry that all of the crew were waiting for, and it was, ah, blows. And that meant that the whale crew had to race to their crafts, to the whale boats, and lower them into the water and chase the whale. So Sam Smith, remember, Sam was the first mate, and he's in charge of the whale boat. And he urged the crew to row with all they had and to get the speed, because I'm sure you would have had to row very hard to catch up to a whale that was obviously trying to escape you. And it took a lot of effort for the boat to finally gain on the whale. But then the whale, in one last defiant act, the whale lifted its tail in the air and struck Sam Smith. Now, Sam was struck with such force that he was actually thrown into the ocean. And Anthony, up on the deck of the Catalpa with his eyeglass to his eye, went, oh, I'm sure he was absolutely flabbergasted by the fact that here was his first mate in the water, the sharks circling because,
What sharks
waiting
do.
for the whale, and what was he going to do? How was he going to get to Australia without this reliable first mate? So fortunately, the sailors on the whale boat pulled Sam Smith back into the boat and rowed him back to the Catalpa. And Smith was bleeding from his head and his neck, and he was probably and breathing quite shallow in a shallow way when he got to the Catalpa. So Anthony sat up with his first mate and kept vigil with him all night, and waiting for him to get better. But then the next morning, despite his weakness from the loss of blood, and undoubtedly he was probably suffering from concussion, Smith rose up from his berth and he staggered to his feet and he insisted that he would direct the cutting up of the whale because that was the job of the first mate. And at that point, Anthony thought, this man is a good man. And I've made no mistake in selecting him. And when the real test comes, at least I'll have one person by my side.
Well, I've been wondering where Joseph Conrad got his idea for Moby Dick from, but I think it's from this story. It's from Sam Smith being whacked by the tail of a whale, and surviving it. But of course, what would you do if you lost a man at sea? Can you hire new ones? Did everybody say stay hale and hearty?
No, well, unfortunately, I remember back on the deck in New Bedford when Brennan was wanting to get on board the ship. And Henry Hathaway had said, oh, to Captain Anthony, well, you usually lose one or two men on a crew, from the crew anyway. And as it happened, they did lose one man, a Robert Kanaka, who was a Sandwich Islander, and he died of a fever and, of course, had to be buried at sea. And that wasn't an unusual thing in those days. I mean, they took on board fresh fruit in order to keep scurvy at bay, but if you got sick, there was no penicillin, so you had to tough it out and come through. Then on the they finally spotted Flores, the island of Flores, on October 14, but the wretched chronometer was still playing up, and Anthony was absolutely alarmed to find that they're 120 miles out of their reckoning. So they moored at Flores for several days, taking on supplies of fresh water and fruit, and then they, of course, had taken several barrels. They'd taken 210 barrels of sperm oil at this stage, and they needed to go on. And when they knew when they got to Fayal, in the Azores, that they would actually hire a merchantman. So there were various ships sailing around the ocean that were the merchantmen that would take goods from one place to another, and picking up the barrels of whale oil and taking them back to New Bedford was part of their job.
Bit like an Uber,
A bit like an Uber.
waiting out there for work, and they get it. So the sperm oil they've got, which is helping to pay for everything, gets taken back to New Bedford. And do we have any idea how much money they make in these days?
They said that their total value of that of what they'd taken at that stage was about $12,000, which is a considerable amount of money in those days. But Anthony was a bit disappointed with that, but he felt that that taking plus whatever they could fetch for Catalpa on the open market would actually pay for the journey. So that was part of his job, not only to rescue the Fenians from here, but he had to. As a businessman, he had to make it pay for itself as well.
Well, in those days, I can just imagine getting across the Atlantic. You're out there hunting whales. Everybody would enjoy a bit of a break, whether it's in the Azores or the Canary Islands. And do they get a break?
Yes, they do. So when they in the final weeks of October, they slid into the harbour at Fayal, which was teeming with whalers and warships and merchantmen, and it was guarded by this massive cliff-top Portuguese fort. I've never been to Fayal. I don't know if you have, Michael, but
No.
sounds pretty amazing.
We'll
So
have
the
to.
crew, of course, were eager to get ashore. They wanted to, go to all the good things that are available on the shore, so in any port. The whale oil, of course, had to be unloaded, and they had to bring on fruit, salt meat, water, all those sorts of things to be stowed away. And Anthony was delighted because he found their letters from Emma, from Richardson, and from Henry Hathaway.
What about this blessed chronometer? Is there a chronometer shop, do we know, in Fayal?
No, well, there isn't. But they, Anthony spotted another New Bedford whaler, the Osprey, which was at anchor, and he negotiated with them to sell him a spare chronometer. He thought it was a bit pricey at $110, but he needed a chronometer, so there weren't any other shops to buy it, so he gladly paid it and took off and felt like he could do the rest of the journey quite comfortably after that.
Now, the other thing I've been wondering about, you were very polite in your language earlier about the crew that arrived in this little holiday resort, really, and they're here and there enjoying themselves. But I suspect they found out where you could get all of the grog pretty quickly and where all the brothels were as well. And then I'm starting to wonder whether they're having such a good time, some of them decide not to go back to the ship.
Well, Michael, you've obviously lived in a port for a while because you know what goes on. So, of course, it was this man Bowles, the third mate that Anthony was a bit suspicious of right from the start. And when Bowles got to Fayal, he actually convinced a few of the others that it was time to jump ship. And perhaps he was sensing that, it wasn't quite the whaling journey that he'd signed up for. But anyway, the crew deserted. So Anthony, of course, was desperate. He'd already dismissed two crew members because of ill health, because you couldn't take people who were ill because they might make everybody else ill on the boat. So he had to turn to what they called a runner for help. And so runners were agents who rounded up sailors who were shanghaied or stranded without passports. And for very steep fees, they smuggled them on board ships who were desperate for bodies. Captain Anthony knew that he was breaking the law and risking his opportunity to go to Australia, but really he felt like he had no choice. So the Catalpa's whale boats were lowered into from the ship, and they wrapped cloth around the oars so that they would muffle the sound as they rowed in to the meeting place to meet these smugglers of people. And they rowed to an arranged meeting point where the sailors who were frantic to leave Fayal scampered on board. But then Anthony, Smith, and Duggan froze because a Portuguese guard boat appeared, and they, with their loud hailer, called out to them, "What are you doing?" But then obviously something happened, and the guards felt like, "Oh, okay, they're just picking up the men from shore leave, having a good time," and they let them pass.
Well, I bet there was occasions when a little bit of money was passed under the gunwale or whatever. And for modern day listeners, I think the runners you've been talking about could probably be best acquainted with a labour hire firm. You grab people and you put them on the workplace. But what about this fellow Brennan? I've never been able to work out Brennan. You know, the Hathaway wanted him on the job. Anthony didn't want him to come anywhere near him. There was the talk of him coming across to Canary Islands or somewhere, so if required, he could fill a position. What was going on with Brennan? Do we know?
Okay, well, we do because Anthony, if he needed a reason to get out of Fayal pretty quickly, it came because Duggan came up to Anthony. Now, remember, Duggan was hired as the ship's carpenter, but he was the Irish operative. So he and Anthony just kept the captain crew relationship. But Duggan approached Anthony with a letter that he'd picked up in Fayal saying that Thomas Brennan, who wanted to board in New Bedford, was on his way and was at the nearby St. Michael's Island, and he was about to board a steamer for Fayal. So Anthony was shocked, and with the sudden appearance, he thought the last thing he needed, having just got this crew on board, was this blustering Brennan who would come in here demanding to be allowed on board, and that would, of course, alert the crew to the fact that, who is this man and why is he taking him on? So Duggan said, Anthony said, okay, let's pack up, get ready. We're leaving tonight. So, at 5:30 on the 6th of November, Anthony took the helm and steered the Catalpa out of the harbour. And next morning, they spotted the steamer coming from St. Michael's, and who was on the deck but Thomas Brennan.
This would be a great, great moment in the movie. The ship's passing.
Exactly. So, and I guess at that stage, we all knew that Anthony didn't want him on board, but it's pretty obvious that Duggan didn't want him on board either, because he was the one who conveyed this message to Captain Anthony. So they're on the same page too.
Exactly where are they heading for when they leave Fayal?
Okay, they're heading for Tenerife, and Tenerife will be their last stop. So Tenerife is further south, and that will be the last port that they'll pull into. Of course, most people would have gone then across to Cape Town and stopped in there and got supplies. But given that it was a British port, Captain Anthony didn't want to stop in South Africa. So Tenerife was his final port, and then he'd head west from them.
Well, remind us all, Margot, how many people know the truth about this journey that we're on?
Well, at this stage on board the Catalpa, it was only Anthony and Duggan.
And even
So
Smith doesn't know, the first mate.
Smith doesn't know, but Anthony knew that he had to tell Smith at some stage in the journey, and he wanted to tell him before they got to Tenerife, so that if Smith chose to leave, then he would have an opportunity to do so. So Anthony was, he was. He'd already tested Smith's courage. He already knew what a courageous man he was. So he really wanted Smith with him. But he called him in for a conversation in the captain's cabin. So he knew that he'd duped Smith, and he hoped that Smith would understand. And he hoped that once he told him the story of the military Fenians, in the establishment in Fremantle, that Smith, who was of Scottish heritage with no particular love for the English, that he would actually take up this passionate cause that Anthony has embraced. But once he told him, Smith just sat there with his mouth wide open. He couldn't believe what he was hearing. And Anthony went on and then told him that he would absolutely exonerate him totally if from any conspiracy. He would swear that he didn't know a thing about it, that and still Smith said nothing. So Anthony waited. What else could he do? And finally, Smith got up from his chair, walked towards Anthony, and said, "Captain Anthony, I will stick with you on this ship if she goes to hell and burns her gibbon."
Well, how delightful. And of course, we shouldn't forget that that Anthony knew there would be a day when he'd have to tell Smith, and he handpicked Smith. So he obviously saw something in this man, some qualities, and it's been borne out all the way through. It's just a great story, a real, in my experience, a real boy's own story. And I guess there weren't any women on board, except when they got to these ports occasionally, they spotted them. But they get to Tenerife, what do they do? How do they fit out? They know that's going to be one long run to Western Australia.
They do. So they arrive in Tenerife on the 19th of November, this was the largest of the Canary Islands. So the Catalpa entered the harbour, but they couldn't dock. They needed to be boarded by the officials to, make sure that everything was all right. And the customs officials demanded to see the ship's papers when they arrived, mainly to see that all the health issues had been, that they were all healthy and they weren't bringing any diseases into to Tenerife, and that they'd been stamped, their health reports had been stamped by the Fayal officials. And they also needed to know how many men were on board. And Anthony's papers said that there were 25 men on board. But they asked him if there were 25, and he was a bit quiet about that because we remember that Bowles had deserted in Fayolle along with a few others, and then they got these other new men on, and the illegal men didn't have really the proper passports. So finally, the officials insisted that everyone come on deck and they do a head count. And when they only found 22, they were asked Anthony to explain what was going on. And then they said to Anthony, "Have you done away with these men?"
What do you mean,
Because,
has he done away with them?
well, done away with them. Apparently, it was quite a. Some captains were incredibly vicious with their crew, and some would have actually beaten their crew, and some apparently hung their crew if they were, not pulling their weight. And they asked this of Anthony. Anthony was shocked at this, and he said, "Absolutely not." And they said, "Well, then he needed to account for it." So Anthony asked if he could be taken ashore because he didn't want the men to go ashore. He didn't want to lose anyone else. So he said, "Take me ashore, and I'll meet with the Portuguese consul, and we will discuss it." So when Anthony, it must have been, we get on occasions this, the character of the man. So when the Portuguese consul met with Anthony, he and Anthony explained, he said, "Yes, okay, I understand. Ships do lose crew, and that's happened to you, but you're free to go, you're free to leave." So while they were ready to go, Duggan and Anthony took a whaleboat ashore, filled it up with lumber and joists, because remember they needed, Duggan was the carpenter, and they needed to prepare for building cabins and spaces for
Oh, really? For
the,
all of the Athenians.
well, this was their last port.
So
So,
they weren't just going to be sleeping on top of each other. They were going to have some little cabins for them. But
well,
how do you
I don't know
explain?
if it was so much cabins as perhaps bunks of,
Thanks.
some sort of spaces for them. They were obviously keeping them separate to the crew, once they took, but they were in preparation for it. And Smith now, of course, knowing that Duggan was a reliable man, he could change his attitude to him as well. So what they told the crew is that they were now heading for the South Atlantic whaling grounds, and that their destination was the River La Plate, which is down between Uruguay and Argentina. So
Oh,
that was the.
they're going right across the southern Atlantic to South America, which, if again, our listeners will appreciate if they have a glance at the at their atlas, is a pretty short run across.
From
It'd be a
Tenerife,
breeze.
it's a pretty, just a straight down run. So that would be the, if whalers didn't find whales in the North Atlantic, they would go to the South Atlantic. That was quite a normal pattern of whaling at the time.
Well, basically, though, if you're going to get to Western Australia, you want to get across near the Cape of Good Hope, the bottom corner there of South Africa, and then try and get some favourable, not too blustery winds to take you across the Indian Ocean.
That's right.
What do these guys do?
Well, they make a little, journey towards the southwest as they're leaving Tenerife to keep up the illusion that they're going down to the South Atlantic. But then Anthony turns the catalpa and heads towards the Cape of Good Hope. And with that was without encountering any problems. However, there were only slight breezes, and so their progress was stalled quite a bit. So on Christmas Eve, 1875, they crossed the equator, and then they remained on a southeasterly course. And it was a bit day after tedious day at that stage as they ploughed along trying to make there. The chronometer reading on the February the 11th placed them still southwest of Africa and waiting to reach the Roaring Forties. So we know from all the shipwrecks on our coast here in Western Australia that once people reached the Roaring Forties, they got blown all the way here.
Now, at this point, they're going this way and that, they're dealing with all the issues you've covered, desertion, getting new people on board from the labour hire firm. And do they have a sort of an agreed meeting place and time with Breslin and Co? Are they working to some deadline?
Well, their meeting place and time was actually January of 1876. And we're now in February of 1876, and they haven't actually got the, they're still south of South Africa rather than in Bunbury.
So Captain Anthony, I'm taking it, would assume that Breslin was pacing the boards in Freo, looking for him, waiting for him.
He was indeed. And we'll come to that chapter next time.
Well, that's the picture. So what then happens? Do the Roaring Forties get them?
Yeah, well, actually, on the night of the 11th of February, they hit a monstrous gale, and it bursts upon them so quickly that they are totally unprepared. The wind ripped the ship's rigging, and it drove giant waves against the hull and across the deck, and rushes of seawater came down into the hold. The storm was explosive, and even for Anthony and Smith, veteran ship's masters, they didn't have enough time to lay on the canvas. So apparently, Michael, what you needed to do here was lay on more canvas in a storm. But it was, and of course, the Catawba was a flat-bottomed, shallow vessel, and it did tip on its side, but it didn't capsize, luckily. So they said later that it came back, righted itself, and was like a bit of a duck resting in between the waves and coming up and down. So after that, Anthony and Smith realized that, this ship would get them through any storm. So that was a very good thing.
Well, the crew must have been pleased to survive it as well, but they must have been in the proverbial way wondering where the fuck are we?
Exactly. So there was a lot of talk amongst the crew, as you would imagine there would be. And Smith luckily overheard someone say that they didn't think they were going to the River La Plate, that they were actually heading for New Zealand. So when Anthony heard this, he was relieved. He thought, well, if they think we're going to New Zealand, I'll keep that up.
Now, tell me this. They're all there. They're probably having a good time by this stage. They're remembering the wonderful time they had at Fayal and on the Canary Islands. And here they are sailing away across the Atlantic. And now they think they're going to New Zealand. Well, how wonderful is that? But does the captain, Anthony, actually know what he's going to do when he gets to Fremantle? Does he know that you can't go up the Swan River? Does he know that there's not many places with big jetties that he can pull alongside? Does he have any idea what he's doing, really?
Well, remember that Captain Anthony had been briefed by Henry Hathaway, and that Henry Hathaway had been on the whaling ship Gazelle that had been in Bunbury back in 1869. So the destination that they were aiming for was Bunbury. However, on the 16th of February, they spotted a merchant ship flying a Union Jack. And at that time, everyone knew that the British had the best chance of any of the coast of Australia, really. And they were about 100 nautical miles southwest of Port Elizabeth in South Africa. And Anthony put the flag up and said, can we board? Can I board and have a gam with the captain there? And he thought that he would try and get a bit of a look at the captain's charts of the West Coast just to reassure himself. He did have one chart, but it was probably not up to date and probably not as detailed as he thought the British captain would have. So he boarded the ship, which was called the Ocean Beauty, and the Englishman said, yes, come on board. So Anthony asked politely if the captain had ever made any voyages across the Indian Ocean before.
Yes.
And the Englishman replied that he'd been doing it all his life. And with the next piece of information, Anthony's jaw dropped open because
What piece of information?
the piece of information was that the person he was sitting across from had been the captain of the Hougoumont, the ship that had brought the Fenians to Fremantle in 1868.
My goodness, who's the captain of
Captain Cousins.
Captain Cousins was the captain of the Hougoumont, which took all of these people, including John Boyle O'Reilly, to Fremantle back in 1868 and out in the high seas, out in the Indian Ocean. Lo and behold, Anthony and Cousins are sitting there having a chat. My goodness, That's
Now,
what
Michael, I
I'm
have to
thinking.
reassure our listeners that we are not making up this fact.
Oh, goodness. So do they stay friendly? What happens?
Well, Anthony was quite taken aback. I mean, he was like, he would have had to compose himself quite well in order to be not revealing anything in this. But anyway, the Captain Cousins was oblivious to Anthony's discomfort in this. And he even asked Anthony if he had, he said that he had transported these people and one of them had escaped, and his name was John Boyle O'Reilly. He asked Anthony if he'd ever heard of this man because he'd escaped on an American whaler.
Didn't reveal he'd probably met him.
He had indeed. And Anthony, of course, denied ever knowing about John Boyle O'Reilly, any escapes, any American whalers coming to Perth. But he did, Captain Anthony did ask if there was any, if Cousins could recommend somewhere where they could refit their boat. And Anthony and Captain Cousins said, well, he would recommend Bunbury, because Bunbury was a great place to refit, and it was quite cheap, he said, in to do it there, and they had a lot of fresh provisions, and that would be a good place to go. So then Anthony thought he may as well push his luck a little bit more, and he asked if Cousins had any charts to spare, or if he could have a look at some and take notes, because that was a captain to captain thing that often went on. And Cousins, being a generous man, said, yes, of course, look, have a look here, take what you like. And Anthony looked and found one of the southwest of Western Australia on a large scale, showing a survey of the Swan River, Fremantle, Bunbury, Rottnest Island, and its lighthouse, and obviously Rockingham as well. So Anthony took his leave from Captain Cousins, wished him Godspeed, and went back to the Catalpa. And once on board, you
Oh,
can imagine
just imagine.
what he and Smith got back into the captain's cabin and absolutely chuckled with glee about what they had found. And imagine that on the high seas, they had found the former captain of the Hougoumont. And they would soon be taking out of the Fremantle prison the very prisoners that Captain Cousins delivered them.
Well, as I keep thinking about the screenplay for the movie, Margot, I'm thinking that scene between Anthony and Cousins sitting there that you just described will be one of the highlights. And everyone will have in the movie theater will have a very big smile on their face, just like Anthony and Smith no doubt had, as you say, and Duggan too, no doubt, when they discovered what they'd run into. A treasure trove. And so there they are. Well, I think it's time because people have to go off and make themselves a cup of tea or something stronger to deal with today's podcast. But what can we expect to hear next time?
Next time we will I'd like to take a little look next time at the prisoners that are here in Fremantle and what was going on here, before we connect up with Breslin and Tom. Breslin
Desmond.
and Desmond, before they, as they arrive in Sydney, what they found in Sydney, and then their journey across to Albany and then to Fremantle.
Well, Margot, the story becomes more gripping, more interesting, more fascinating. And remembering, folks, it's just 75 years all of this was happening before I was born. See you next time, Margot.
See you next time, Michael. Thank you very much.